Well, folks, let's get started. Thanks for coming out. And just a couple of overarching pictures before we get into our work today. So we did, on Sunday afternoon, we studied the Gospel of Matthew because that was the assigned lesson for the Eucharistic service. We come back to Matthew today. I'll say a little bit more about that. We just did a mini-series on the Gospel of Mary. And the last two sessions of this weekday series is going to be the Odes of Solomon. It's one of these newly discovered texts, and it's totally misnamed, as many texts in and outside the Bible are, as far as I know. The Odes of Solomon were discovered, and they are a first century document that sound very much like the hymns of the Hebrew Scriptures, with one major difference, and that is Jesus is in them. So basically, it's a first century Christ-related book of Psalms. So that'll be tomorrow and Friday. And then Saturday, we prepare for the Eucharist on Sunday with another Matthean text. So we'll assign Matthew Gospel. To say that more substantively, so in the 2 weeks I'm here, I'm working mostly on notions of vulnerability in Scripture. So we focused on the vulnerableness of Mary in the Gospel of Mary, the vulnerableness on Sunday of what it means to be a baby community, today we'll do more of that. The Odes of Solomon are really stunningly vulnerable because they're singing in the midst of Roman violence. And so tomorrow and the next day will be probably, in many ways, the focus of what it means to be vulnerable in the first century as Christ followers. So anyway, just to let you know what I think I'm up to, and to also remind you that basically it's your agenda too in every session. So we'll be willing to go where your reading takes us as well. So the handout today is then three texts from the Gospel of Matthew. Frankly, I was planning on concentrating on chapter 10 of Matthew, but when I discovered that was the assigned text for Sunday that we're going to be studying on Saturday, I thought that would be totally weird to teach non-sequence to the same text. Let's take them in turns. Before we do that, I'll say just a little bit about the Gospel of Matthew, the way I have learned it, and again reminding you that those of us who think we know something about the first century are both at least half of the time lying. The Gospel of Matthew seems to have been the third gospel written that we know of. Most folks these days are pretty sure that the Gospel of Thomas was written before any other gospel. The Gospel then of Mark is the first canonical gospel, and the Gospel of Matthew, the second canonical gospel. The Gospel of Matthew, it seems quite probably to have the Gospel of Mark in front of it. In other words, one could really say in some ways that the Gospel of Matthew is a version of the Gospel of Mark. So Matthew follows Mark's plot. And so does Luke, but John does not. We sometimes think, oh, that just must be what really happened because Matthew, Mark, and Luke agree on the plot. But it's most likely that Mark's text, which I'll be teaching next week in part, is so riveting as a story that Matthew and Luke took it. And then what we are pretty sure happened, because there are 235 teaching verses in that Matthew and Luke share that Mark doesn't have. Say that again. So there's a big portion of Matthew and Luke that's the same, basically the same teachings, but it's not in Mark. And then Mark, of course, was the first that Matthew and Luke copied. So I'm still kind of clinging to a 19th century German thought, which has held up pretty much, and that is that Matthew, in addition to having Mark's book in front of Matthew as it's writing, had another book. And we call this Q, or the source, Q because the German word for source begins with Q, Quelle. And so what we think is that Matthew is taking this long set of sayings of Jesus in a book we don't have anymore, but would look something like the Gospel of Thomas, because the Gospel of Thomas is only sayings of Jesus. But this is, we think, another book of the sayings of Jesus that we don't have, but we put together because Matthew and Luke agree on it. So Matthew then has those sayings and fits them in to Mark's story. As Luke does, but Luke fits them in different places of Mark's story. Scholars tend to agree when Matthew was written, and that's the 80s. So about maybe 15 years after the destruction of Jerusalem. Matthew, as I said, I tend to think that all of the New Testament thought of itself, I mean, there was no New Testament when these things were written, but all that's in the New Testament, of those individual books, thought of themselves as some kind of funky Jew. That is, because Judaism wasn't really existent, but spiritual Israel was diverse. And so there are a whole bunch of different kinds of "I belong to Israel" in the first century. Even though the majority of people that are reading these things and maybe writing them are Gentiles, they are saying they belong to Israel. But Matthew is the clearest. Of all the books in the New Testament, it's clear that Matthew knows that it belongs to Israel. Its story of Jesus means to say that Jesus belongs to Israel. Of course, we have no stories about Jesus that ever said that Jesus said, "I'm the first Christian," or "I'm going to start a new religion."
That's one of the lost ones.
Even though all of the different stories of Jesus in the different Gospels are there, Jesus never says, "And I'm going to start a new religion." Always assumes that he belongs to Israel. Was Matthew written? We have really not much of a clue. 20 years ago, scholars were saying probably Syria and the city of Antioch. And now a number of scholars are saying, well, maybe even Galilee. And it's such a moving target trying to say where these texts were written. So I'm not sure, but to let you know what others know. Just let me stop for a moment for thoughts, questions, protests.
I guess I want to ask a question and then maybe posit a theory. When did the Muslim faith begin?
That would be about 6 centuries later.
6 centuries. Uh-huh. I wonder if what is happening with the Muslim faith is the same thing that has happened with Christianity, that there are several different sects that are coming about that don't quite believe what they what was thought of back in the 6th century, and that eventually it will be something different, and they're 6 centuries behind Christianity, so we won't see that for a while.
Yeah, and because I've been doing so much work on the 100 or so new discoveries from the earliest Christianity, I've been studying a lot of how in the world the canon came into existence. And I'm thinking more and more that it was intentionally collected diversity, not uniformity. I mean, so for instance, Irenaeus in the 2nd century is the first person to say we should have 4 gospels. And he names what he thinks, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. But then he gives a funny and interesting answer to why one should have 4 gospels, because he clearly knows that there are probably 15 or 20 of them, as we also do know. And he says, because there are 4 winds that blow and 4 corners to the earth. I mean, that answer doesn't work for us in our time, right? In other words, so he says the reason you have for these 4 gospels is because the world is shaped like that, which we don't think anymore. But the coolest thing for me, when you say, so how did the New Testament eventually come into being? He is saying why we want 4 gospels, not 1, is because they're all different. They're from different corners. So to begin to think about the richness of Scripture, not because it always has the one right answer, but because it has at least 4 different answers. Ron.
So to follow up on your thoughts, I've had similar questions, and I read a really good book. I can tell you what it is later on that kind of describes it. But there is a lot of diversity that I can, you know, that I understand in Islam. And the other thing that I guess occurs to me after I've read up on some of this is that similar to what we've seen in Judaism and Christianity, Reformation comes out of crisis. You know, you're facing a threat, and you recognize that things must change, so you canonize your scripture, or you establish an orthodoxy, or you whatever it is. You name a new center. You place the capital in a new city that seems more fitting. All those steps are, you know, steps to try to stabilize the core faith. Yeah. So I wouldn't be at all surprised if we see a reformation of sorts. It's not going to be like Christianity, but I think there'll be a reformation sort of like that.
What's the audience that Matthew is writing his gospel for, and why would it even, I guess, does it matter?
So what I say now will be pretentious. So yeah, that's the question for me about all of this, and I think that, again, here for once scholars are relatively in agreement, and that is that it is intensely Israel-focused. So I said on Sunday, for instance, there are five, Jesus makes five large speeches in Matthew, and that's because it's meant to correspond to the five books of the Torah. Jesus says only in Matthew, not one punctuation mark or one letter can be avoided from obeying the Torah. I often think, what would a conversation between Matthew and Paul be like? In that regard. So first thing, really Israel focused. Again, even though Israel as a nation has been conquered. But there is not as in Mark and Luke, where Mark and Luke, I think, are radically interested in going beyond Israel and explicitly addressing Gentiles. Matthew has a small opening for Gentiles. So most scholars would say Matthew's audience is densely Israel-centered with a few Gentiles. So in other words, it doesn't condemn Gentiles, although we're going to read a text in which it comes close to that. Well, let's look at that text. On the left-hand side, chapter 15, and excuse us, please, for the light print on the printer this morning. If you can't see it, hold it up to the light or something. But this was the best I did as I photocopied. Let's just read, beginning with verse 21 and going through 28 of chapter 15. We'll do it as we have been doing, by and large. I'll start and then I'll stop and somebody else will pick up until we've got those verses read. On going away from that place, Jesus went to the country around Tyre and Sidon. There, a Canaanite woman of that district came out and began calling to Jesus.
"Take pity on me, Master, son of David. My daughter is grievously possessed by a demon."
But Jesus did not say a word to her, and his followers came up and begged him to give in. "She keeps calling out after us," they said. "I was not sent," he replied, "to anyone except the lost sheep of Israel."
But the woman came and, bowing to the ground before him, said, "Master, help me."
"It is not fair," he retorted, "to take children's food and throw it to the dogs."
"Yes, Master," she said, "but even dogs do feed on the scraps that fall from their owner's table."
"Woman, your confidence is great," Jesus answered. "It will be as you wish." And her daughter was healed that very hour.
All right. One of the more difficult pieces of the New Testament, I think, for anyone to read. Let's just sort of go over how the interaction with the Canaanite woman and Jesus went. By the way, this text is in Mark. In Mark, she is called a Syrophoenician woman. That's actually this. They give you Tyre and Sidon in this, but then they call her a Canaanite woman. That's almost certainly because Matthew wants everything to look as Israel-centered as possible. There was no such thing as Canaan in the first century. But this is sort of romanticizing the Israel-centeredness of it. Well, so, okay, she comes. What's wrong for her? Yes.
Her. It's also kind of provocative, isn't it? Because Canaan kind of has a bad
Oh, totally,
reputation,
yeah.
In the Old Testament.
Yeah, well, this, yes, exactly. Canaan is sort of Israel and sort of not, right, in the Hebrew Scriptures. Yeah, very important. That actually is one of the other reasons that this is happening. We'll see how this is very carefully composed by Mark and then Matthew. So, but what happens to, why is the woman coming to Jesus?
Her daughter.
Yeah. And is she polite? Sort of. But she keeps bothering him, right? And finally, we have, so Jesus doesn't say anything to her, right, at first. And then Jesus explains why. And what's why?
Not what he came to do.
But he came to do what?
The sheep of Israel.
Just concentrate on the sheep of Israel. Right? Okay. Notice how Israel-centric this is. We're going to need to ask questions about Jesus saying that. Everybody feel comfortable with Jesus saying that? No, Bill says. Anybody? In other words, it is kind of since we're not the lost sheep of Israel. In other words, there's sort of questions for us. But does she give up when he says, "Well, actually, since you don't belong to Israel, I'm not dealing with you."
Not my problem.
Not my problem,
yeah.
Or sort of your problem, right? Did she give up? No, Master, help me. And then his answer that comes back, whew, okay, what is it?
She's a dog.
She's a dog, right.
Yeah.
And yeah. That is really bad.
Yeah, it's not fair to take the children's food, that is Israel, and throw it to the dogs. So the Greek of the word dog has two slurs attached to it. So it's a double slur. It's the B word. Everybody know the feminine B word? This is, of course, still in English.
All us women know it.
Yeah, right, exactly. Roxy, yes. So, yes. This the first insult here is that she is a dog because she's a woman. But interestingly enough, at that time, a lot of Israel's literature also says that foreigners are dogs too. So actually she admits it's a double insult because she's both. She's a woman and she's a foreigner. So he rejects her because she's a woman and because she's foreign. Other readings are welcome here. If you would like to read this other ways, especially in Greek, I can't read it anything but a B word and an anti-foreigner.
Are there things that we need to know about first century dogs?
Don't tell me more.
I'm thinking about first century baths. And how helpful more knowledge of that is. You know, like we think of like the cute little Pomeranian that does adorable things and we teach to do agility tricks, right? Is this different than that? Is this somehow an even worse thing to be saying, or are they keeping pets, or what are dogs
for? Oh, thank you. Well, so a dog is mainly an agricultural worker and friend, right? So we know about that from the basically the herding jobs in agricultural Europe. So Israel. So it's that the dog is a functional helper and a helper to humans.
Part of security also.
Also part of security, but I think the heavy lifting is sheep and cattle. There's a little bit of domestication, but the domestication is pretty intensely focused on the work. But since the population is growing there, you tend to have a lot of stray dogs. So I don't know how many of you have been in other cultures where dogs aren't really owned, but in both larger villages and cities, stray dogs are a nuisance. So I think this insult comes from the nuisance dimension of city and big town dogs.
I don't think this is helping. It's only getting worse.
I don't think Joan was asking me to solve all the problems, it's getting worse. That's true.
So a consumer of resources that is an unwelcome consumer of resources.
Oh, that's a nice further elaboration of the function. Yes.
I was curious about the "it's not fair" part.
Hmm. It's not fair.
It's not fair implies some sort of, I don't know, standard against which you compare. Hmm. I'm having trouble wrapping my mind around that part.
Well, that's where I got the consumer of resources, because if we have limited resources, you give them to the children, not to the dogs.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would hook that back to the lost sheep of Israel. In that, of course, I mean, basically Israel is now lost, right? The Romans have taken it over. And when Matthew was writing, Matthew changes this a little bit. Actually, Mark, Jesus is just as insulting in Mark in this story as Matthew, but the tone of the is a little bit changed. So Jerusalem has been destroyed, left in ruins, and the temple has been torn down by the Romans. And the Romans have refused to let Jerusalem be rebuilt. They don't let Jerusalem to be rebuilt for 40 years, just to rub it into them. And so I think it is fair probably would have to do with, look at how much trouble we're in Israel.
So I read a really good book by Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, and he kind of addresses this discomfort we have with the negative side of God. I mean, he hits it head on. It's a really good book. It's called Not in God's Name. Highly recommend it. And one of the things he points out, I think, is that this discomfort is not only in the New Testament, it's in the Old Testament. And it's hard for people to, as you said, wrap their heads around the negativity sometimes that comes through associated with God. Mm-hmm. And yet God is God. So we don't really get to choose how God's going to act and who God is and so on and so forth. The temptation then is to say, well, there's Satan working here. You know, Satan's somehow influencing this discussion. He's somehow seizing the moment and manipulating people. But Rabbi Sacks says that's a wrong interpretation. Mm. We need to accept that God's going to act in uncomfortable ways. Mm. which I think is really thought-provoking.
I see what you're going to run. I refuse to worship that God. I would say. I mean, the Sachs argument is kind in an interesting way.
Yeah.
But it feels to me as if, and I think that Matthew and Mark know that Jesus is saying the wrong thing. I'm not sure, but what I want to hold out is not too far away from here, but that simply Jesus is in error. So now watch what happens, and you'll see whether this works or not. But I want to say that's the point, and we who need Jesus to be perfect, because that's what Christian dogma is. See, this is pre-dogma.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I want to suggest that Mark and Matthew are comfortable with an imperfect Jesus. I think what's really helpful also about what you're saying, however, is that I think that Matthew thinks of Jesus is somewhat divine. So that would say this is a picture of a somewhat divine, flawed Jesus. So just to finish the story then, what's her answer back to Jesus? So he just double insulted her. Roxy?
Yeah, but in light of what we've been talking about, it seems to me like she could have said, well, you need dogs to round up the sheep of Israel.
And
it takes a bitch to do it.
Yes, woman power.
She is not so challenging, is she? She's saying, well, you need dogs to lick up the scraps.
But you actually like the dogs too, or you wouldn't slip them stuff under the table.
Well, see, but I'm getting something that's slightly different out of that, because to me it's about abundance. She's saying there's plenty to go around. Even after the children are done eating, there's enough left to go around. And I don't know, sometimes when I'm teaching things, I deliberately say the wrong thing to get people to say, oh, but wait, it doesn't work like that. So, I kind of saw this as maybe he is the flawed Jesus who's just cranky, or maybe he's making his disciples go through the thought process themselves to say, no, that's not right. It should be this way.
You're giving him an out.
Well, I find that is often a very effective teaching strategy myself.
Yeah.
Because it invites critical thinking.
Yeah, but would it work in your classroom to triple insult people on the way by? What's your point?
Sometimes yes, actually. Actually, so
it's a risky strategy.
Well, it is a risky strategy.
It is. Yeah. And if it's done skillfully, you get people to say, you can't do that. Really? Why not? And then the discussion.
Right.
And then the critical thinking.
But this is a racial slur.
And a gender slur.
The ancient world, she would have been super comfortable with the gender slide. I mean, that happened everywhere, right? Mm-hmm. But the racial slur is we really toned down Jesus's language here to make us the more comfortable, I think, with what Jesus is saying.
Yeah.
And just to remember that Mark and Matthew are quite woman positive in their text. In other words, women show up when no one else does. In both of those gospels, especially in Mark. So, in other words, it feels to me as if the larger arc of these gospels is to show how central in leadership women are. Here, Jesus goes against that grain. So in other words, the possibility here is that Matthew as author is not the same as Jesus. In other words, Jesus is a character in Matthew's larger story, and the hero, but a flawed one, possibly. Okay.
It also seemed to me that Jesus was just testing her faith and she passed with flying colors.
Okay, so you and Melissa are saying that Jesus is the smarter one. Right?
Well, I assume that from the beginning.
Uh-huh. That's the way we were taught, isn't it?
Right. Well, yeah. But also to what you were saying about being woman positive, this is a demonstration that even if he was saying the wrong thing, the woman got it. That there is abundance and there is enough for all, despite the insult and the rejection.
Well, let's see what he does say in 28. So he compliments her on her confidence. So the way I read that is, you got insulted and you were confident anyway because you wanted to help your daughter. And who is now healed. I'll just do a little bit of, I don't like doing Greek stuff because it makes like the scholar think, it makes you think the scholars know more than you. The word here that is translated confidence is, the Greek word is pistis, and almost always you will see that translated not as confidence. Anybody know what it is?
Faith
or belief. So in other words, in almost all your, I influenced the translation of this text in print, and I know that pistis in ordinary Greek means confidence. It has sub-meanings of belief or faith, but they're not the main ones. But here it seems to me like the meaning is, look at how confident she is. I see how confident. Good job.
It seems more like desperation, though. I mean, she's gone through this being ignored, being insulted, and it's like, I don't care. Whatever I got to do to get my daughter healed.
Yeah.
And so I don't see that quite as much as confidence, as just love and desperation.
I like, that's where I would read the story, and I think Matthew wants us to see her confidence, mainly because Matthew and Mark keep using that word, like, you remember the woman with the flow of blood? Jesus also commends her for her confidence, for her pistis. In other words, pistis doesn't mean desperation.
Right.
So I'm trying to go with the several. But I just want to say that we've misunderstood this text, because it usually says your belief has saved you,
yeah.
or your faith has saved you. And faith then gets read as somehow the first Christian or something like that. So
it's also interesting that her confidence can create a change for someone who is not her, mm-hmm. who is not involved in the dialogue.
Right. Yeah, and you'll see throughout the healings of Jesus in Mark and Matthew, what Jesus keeps saying is, it was your confidence that saved you. Mm-hmm. Remember? It's your belief, the translation, you know. Every time, it's you that did it. So it's really interesting that Jesus himself, in a whole bunch of healings, says, actually, it was you that healed. And he, yes?
Can I invite more scholarly pretension?
Yes. No.
Can you tell us more about the word woman? Is this the, what is he calling her?
It's a pretty straightforward word. It doesn't have subtext by and large.
It's not gune, which is...
It's gune, yes.
Okay, and that isn't... Okay, so this is where my little bit of greed might be dangerous. it's not the olive branch, the extension of a intimate connection. It's more mechanical, you're saying? Because in other interactions, he's using this word, and it's like, at least I've been taught, it's like a bombshell of compassion. You know, a word that a first century man would not use in public.
There is part of gune that can mean that, okay. And I like what you say, because it's in the conversion of Jesus' state. I mean, it's when Jesus changes his mind about her.
Sure.
I think there could be some of that there. Mm-hmm. No.
It's
I
the
think
same word
helpful.
He uses when he addresses his mother.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And he assumed he loved.
It's a dime a dozen word in so many other texts as well. But I think that sometimes is an intimate has intimate meanings as well.
Her pestering, I see that in the Old Testament. What about Lot? Oh, if there's 100 good ones, you know, will you save the city? Oh, if there's 10, will you save? And God always gives in over and over. And that seems to be kind of a theme through the whole of the Bible itself. People beg God all the time.
See, that's the thing I'm thinking, and it's my kind of the traditional teaching on Jesus, is that God always gives choice. He always gives people the chance, the choice to love. Because if he didn't, and this is like my anti, you know, Calvinist sort of thing coming out, if he didn't, it wouldn't be love. It's interesting to hear, like, if he did insult her, that's a whole level, another level of, like, challenge to her faith or choice to believe that he could heal. But I'm seeing it through that lens. Like,
mm-hmm. Good.
Wow, she really was persistent in that belief that she could get power and healing from Jesus. And he honors that choice.
Well, the other question that I have as we're talking about this is, you know, she was a foreigner and a woman, so was being rejected, insulted, part of her baseline lived experience.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't something out of the ordinary at all.
Yeah, no big deal.
Not that it was no big deal, but that it was, she was used to it, yeah.
And I think I tend to see these outsider women in Mark and Matthew as ending up being the primary examples, even often more than Jesus. And Jesus starts pointing to them as well. Well, I want to move on to another text. And we've had such a good time with this one. And let's just notice that I think a number of us have different takes on this. What I'm wanting you to consider is Jesus as vulnerable in that he's wrong and changes his mind. Chuck?
Yeah, I think I guess I've been wrestling with that for the last few minutes, that I see maybe the possibility that Jesus steps out of the divine for a minute and he's struggling with his own being part of humanity. You know, that the...
Those are dangerous words.
Yeah, it brushes in on him, but he overcomes that, right? So I can connect on some level that, you know, that he too has these struggles. So if it's Son of God, Son of Man, you know, I am both divine and I am both human, to me, that touches deeply into our humanity and our own struggle, and that we struggle to be like Jesus, or we struggle to be and we want to say the right thing, but it doesn't always come out that way, right? And we find ourselves in really bad places because that was not our intention, but that's what he said. And that there is a check by, in the gospel here, whoever was surrounding him, that this story comes out of, that there are others who are pointing, say, Jesus, you might be wrong about this. And to me, that's very interesting.
Yeah.
It takes it a little bit off the pedestal, and yet there's this divinity that rises up in spite of that.
And I would suggest your point can be even stronger if you take Nicaea out of the Gospel of Matthew. In other words,
tell me more about that.
That, you know, God and human, that's a later doctrinal formulation. So what if this is simply a not all-powerful God or a divinity presence that is all mixed up with humanity, as you make? In other words, I don't think that Matthew has any interest in systematic theology that Nicaea does.
Well,
also, as I'm understanding it, Jesus wasn't born as Christ. Jesus came into being Christ. Christ was from the beginning. Jesus was a baby who was born, who then came there, and it seems like he's still learning that here. Mm. That maybe, yes, he can do everything, when right then he's feeling like, no, what I came to do was this. I have a job, and you're distracting me from it. And then it's a teachable moment for him.
I'm going to misuse what you just said to get us into the next text, okay, which is at the end of the Gospel of Matthew. We're going to skip to the second one because we've been doing such good work. But let's read, if you would, chapter 27. It starts at the bottom of the page. You see my cut and paste where it says, I can't even read it.
It's sort of, passerby.
The passerby, yeah. Let's read down through, let's say, 50. The passersby railed at him. Jesus is on the cross.
What verse are you starting with?
It's at the bottom of the middle.
Oh, I see.
Shaking their heads.
Okay.
As they said, you who destroy the temple and build one in 3 days, save yourself, if you are God's son. Come down from the cross.
In the same way that the chief priests with the scholars and elders said in mockery, he saved others, but he cannot save himself. He is the King of Israel. Let him come down from the cross now, and we will believe in him.
He has trusted in God. If God wants him, let him deliver him now. He said, I am God's son.
Even the robbers who were crucified with him insulted him in the same way.
After midday, a darkness came over all the country, lasting until 3 in the afternoon.
Nobody wants this one.
I got it. About 3, Jesus called out loudly, Eloi, Eloi, lema sabachthani. That is to say, my God, why have you abandoned me?
Some of those standing by heard this and said, the man is calling for Elijah.
One of them immediately ran and took a sponge and filling it with common wine, put it on the end of a rod and offered it to him to drink. But the rest said, wait and let us see if Elijah is coming to save him. But Jesus, uttering another loud cry, gave up his spirit.
Let's stop there. So here, just to let you know, Mark and Matthew have almost the same text right here. Luke and John are quite different from it. But Mark and Matthew are the same. So we all have heard this, I think, before, most of us at least. And we have all, anyone here not been to a 7 last words of Christ service? Okay. No? No, nobody? So somebody has not. Good Friday, where you have seven torturous sermons on 7 last words of Jesus on the cross. If you would notice here, Jesus doesn't have 7 words from the cross. He has 1, right? This is the only thing Jesus says on the cross in Mark and Matthew. And what does he say?
It is finished.
Where are you, Jefferson?
Why have you abandoned me? I mean, it is an accusation to God of abandonment.
It's also the first verse of Psalm 20.
Yes.
22.
I love that. It's a triple meaning, I think. Let's stay with
it. Any better.
Excuse me? No, I think it actually gets more complicated.
Right.
In an intentional way. But let's just stay with the plot level here. Notice what happens up to here. Everybody's yelling and screaming at him, right? So the story pictures him as completely abandoned. It deals with the abandonment itself in the story. And he dies having been yelling at God. I'm not saying you want to have that story. I'm saying I think Matthew and Mark do have that story. And then let's go, if somebody's getting nervous, let's go to what Ron said. If you read Psalm 22, this is the first verse of Psalm 22. My God, why have you abandoned me? Psalm 22, the first 19 verses, are the story of a debtor who is completely broke, surrounded by people who are trying to collect his debts, and they even divide his clothes so they can get part of the debt. So that's the story. It's a picture of abandonment. And in Psalm 22, the prayer is saying, listen, you helped my parents, you helped my grandparents, now why aren't you helping me? And so throughout the first 19 verses of Psalm 22, you have an abandoned peasant with no money, yelling at God and saying, please, please help me. So this really fits with Jesus being abandoned. What the wonderful wink that Ron has given us is that psalm, those first 19 verses, seem to have gotten so popular in Israel because there were so many peasants going broke that it became a popular prayer. God, help us! And it became so much so popular in Israel as a prayer of desperation that the Psalter makers added it. But they didn't want to have it end on a down note. So the rest of Psalm 22 is in the third person, in which it says, God will always help the poor. And God is going to make a new people. And they're going to be born again. So in other words, if you read the whole of our Psalm 22, you have both a desperate cry for help and a from above voice that says things are going to be all right.
So when he says this, would the people who heard that have referenced just the first 19 verses, or what we know as Psalm 22?
If we had 20 more minutes to talk, I wouldn't just blab on what I think is going on, but I'll do that since you know that it may be wrong. I think this is not about what Jesus says. This is about what Mark and Matthew wrote. This is Mark and Matthew's story about how to live in desperate times.
They're painting a picture of the event.
Right. Partly because, of course, Luke and John don't have those words, but also because I'm not sure anybody knows what Jesus said from the cross. These are all words of gospel writers who are not recording history, but trying to give a special kind of way to live. And in this case, the way, the big question is, how do we live in the middle of desperate times of violence?
So I would like to change my question to, when the writer of this story chose those words,
sorry,
would the reader be referencing the first 19 verses or what we now know as Psalm 22? So what's the point of putting this in here, I guess?
I apologize for being so pedantic. I'm sorry. The latter. I think that this is, but in that case, and if the writer and reader know the Psalm 19 background, this doesn't make the story less desperate, but it gives a tiny bit of hope.
Thank you. You answered my question.
Yeah, right. Yes. So in other words, this gives a subtext. When I was in seminary and needed this all to work out, I thought they know Psalm 19 and it's, everything's going to be all right. I think this is a stark, beautifully written story of desperation that has just the slightest hint of a voice that you can almost hear.
What do you do about the person who kind of misinterprets that Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani as a call for Elijah?
Yet again, nobody understands him.
Okay.
So I want to then just suggest here that we have a Jesus at the end in which he didn't quite learn it all, Elaine, in the process. In other words, at this last, this is a picture that at best is desperation, and maybe it's going to be like Psalm 22. So that I would want to say Matthew throughout has a vulnerable Jesus.
Would that be saying Jesus is both divine and human, perhaps?
Well, from my point of view, and forgive my stubbornness, I think there's more, yes, that could be, but that's kind of the Nicene solution. What I keep wanting to read this in first century context, when you have an oppressor over everything in your society, who was... Josephus, the Jewish historian of the first century, says that Pilate crucified 10,000 people just in Israel. Everybody, every family in Israel has had somebody crucified. Almost everyone has had somebody been made a slave and taken away. All of them are being taxed to death. And people keep saying, hey, you're going to give this to the emperor too? For me, I want to give Mark and Matthew the job of making sense of why what following Jesus means in this time in which everybody is so desperately anxious and hurt. So, I have the too much of the floor now, but that's where I'm going. I'm wanting us to say, what if the Gospels are a story of a good healer? We skip the time in which some of his disciples can't heal, and in Matthew and Mark, he doesn't always successfully heal. But what about if this is a somewhat divine, somewhat flawed, vulnerable person that that Matthew invites us to follow? That's, it may not be like good enough.
But there's a very real possibility that Elijah could show up. so much so that we're going to stay here and wait. But wait a second here, guys. Yes. It's like, you know, right? We better stay here because Elijah might really show up. And not like in the Seder meal where you go and you look out the door to see if Elijah's there. Like, they really think that there's a real possibility that Elijah could show up here.
But eventually they...
Well, right.
So, I'm interested at least as much in us as them now. It seems to me like knowing desperateness and difficulty in our lives is a pretty crucial task. And so, for me, the 20th century has had to come to terms, first of all, with the Holocaust, right? In which the good and all-powerful God has seemed not quite viable. So let's just go through that for a moment. If God is good and all-powerful, what about killing 6 million Jews? We haven't been able to find a plan for the good and all-powerful God to explain that. And that's just one. I mean, in other words, Cambodia or Democratic Republic of the Congo, in which hundreds of thousands are killed. So it seems to me like 20th and 21st century consciousness has put us in the place where the standard good and all-powerful God is questionable.
So can I throw in there Joseph Campbell's idea, archetype of the wounded healer?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so in other words, here is a possibility for me, for us to say that actually the first century and the 21st century are lining up hauntingly well. Mm-hmm. So in other words, there was this big time in which Christianity was in charge, and God and Christianity merged, and everything was going to be taken care of for us by an all-powerful and good God. I find myself, and many people I talk to these days, kind of on edge personally about those kind of questions, much less the Holocaust. So those are kind of contemporary questions that I feel we need to be thinking through, and whether these gospels, which do have some vulnerability in them, might be of help to us. Oh, I'm out. Let's go, Ron, and I apologize for going over. I'm not trying to dodge you. I'm going to stay here. Yeah, I'm happy to stay here.
So my thought is, this is not actually inconsistent with the Old Testament either. I read a book about, and there are many cases where there seems to be this wrestling between God and humans to try, and you don't quite know how things are going to turn out. One of the really good examples I can think of is, and I read this book a long time ago, I can't remember what the name of it is, but it's a description of Abraham and God. And the point of the book is that the relationship that was established was primarily an evolution of God's attitude toward Abraham, not Abraham's attitude toward God. Abraham's pretty consistent throughout, you know, wonderful, these chapters. But it's God that has to come around to the conclusion that it would be a good idea to establish this relationship.
I apologize for mismanaging our time this morning. And actually, Odes of Solomon tomorrow keeps us right at the heart of this. You'll find Jesus actually sings in the Odes of Solomon about hard times. Mm-hmm.